I'm Nick. I'm an artist based at Somerset House Studios in London. I'm interested in sound and how it plays with the imagination. And I'm building a machine. Bang.
Brown and furry.
An axe cutting through a watermelon.
Fire. Peace.
The beginning.
Bubble wrap. Thundering rain.
Me.
I'm building a machine that can translate words into sounds, audible experiences. In this podcast, I discuss this idea with some amazing minds. I want to know what they think about the meaning of language, perception, and reality. I hope what I learn from talking to them will help me build this machine. I'm about to meet Professor Donald Hoffman, who's a professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University of California, Irvine. And I wanted to meet him for a really, really long time because of his incredible theory called matter as consciousness, in which he proposes that the reality that we experience through our senses is nothing like reality as it really is. And if we're to believe what he says, it throws up some pretty major questions for our project.
Yeah, I'm Don Hoffman, and I'm a professor of cognitive sciences at the University of California at Irvine. And I have studied artificial intelligence, visual perception, biological and machine. I study evolution and the question, have we evolved to see reality as it is? And I've done some work in evolutionary psychology. And I'm also now working on a mathematical theory of consciousness and trying to understand consciousness on its own terms and perhaps even as a model of the ultimate nature of reality.
I want to create a machine which will transform the spoken word into sound. And so in a sense, what we're trying to do is invert speech or language so that the thought becomes manifest.
That's a wonderful idea.
But it's fraught with issues, not least the fact that the objective translation of a word into meaning is potentially impossible. And then we find your theory, which suggests that there is no objective reality whatsoever in any case, which completely derails what we're doing. We met at the Hay-on-Wye Festival. We sat down on a grassy knoll behind a tent full of folk musicians. And I asked Don to explain what he meant by matter as consciousness.
What we take to be reality, space and time and physical objects around us, I propose that really what that is just a user interface that evolution has shaped in us and is there to hide reality, is there to hide the truth, whatever that might be, and it's there just to give us what we need to know to act in a way to stay alive. We're not seeing reality as it is. None of our perceptions are true in the sense that none of our perceptions tell us about the true nature of an objective reality. Space and time and physical objects are merely data structures that we employ to represent fitness payoffs, and they have nothing to say about the ultimate nature of truth or reality.
I think what Don means by a fitness payoff is a situational or evolutionary advantage. But, I mean, how does he know?
With some graduate students, we ran hundreds of thousands of trials of evolutionary game simulations in which we had organisms that saw the truth and organisms that saw none of the truth but were just tuned to the fitness payoffs. And we had them compete. And we found repeatedly that the organisms that saw the truth went extinct when they tried to compete against organisms of equal complexity that saw no truth but were just tuned to fitness.
What Don's saying is that we don't see the world as it actually is, but rather we see it in terms of what we need to see in order to survive. So what I want to know is, how does sound fit into this?
In that framework, when we hear sounds, we're going to have certain emotional reactions to them, which are going to also be coding for certain fitness payoffs. The fact that we have emotional reactions to sounds is not an accident. So for example, very, very low frequency, high energy sounds really grab our attention. That suggests that something big, possibly a predator, is stomping around nearby. The crying sound of a child, we're programmed to respond to that emotionally. There's going to be individual differences, right? I mean, if you've been raised in certain areas where there are certain sounds that are characteristic of that area and that I haven't been raised in, then you'll have emotional reactions that I won't. So it's not like it's all pre-programmed completely, but there'll be certain things that we're all pre-programmed. A scream is probably universally an alarming kind of thing. And other species have the same thing. There are alarm calls and so forth that they give that they're sort of pre-wired to understand what the impact of those things are. The key point about perception from an evolutionary point of view is that there's an enormous amount of fitness payoff information that's potentially relevant to us. If we had to pay attention to all of that, we would be overwhelmed. It would be too much for us. We wouldn't be able to process it, and we would die. So forget reality. That's too complicated. It's out of the question. How can we present the organism with just the information about fitness that it needs without overwhelming it? And physical objects, as well as space-time, are a solution to that computational problem.
Wait a minute. So he's not just saying that we see what we need to see. He's actually saying that our brains are making this stuff up.
This, by the way, is not the way anybody else is thinking about it. Most people are thinking about object perception as we're just recovering the true properties of pre-existing objects. When I see an apple, I'm recovering the true, in the normal case, if things are going well, the shape I see is a good approximation to the real shape, the color I see is a good approximation to the real color, and so forth. And the sounds I hear are good approximations to the real vibrations in a real physical world that are out there. And that's the standard view. I'm suggesting that there's a far more interesting way to think about perception. There is an interesting problem that we haven't even thought about. When we see a physical object, we're not just sort of seeing, like I see a red apple in front of me. That's not because I'm taking a picture of a real red apple and I'm seeing the truth about a real red apple. It's quite different. It's rather that when I look over there and I have the experience of a red apple, I'm creating a data structure that I need to grab fitness payoffs. It's red, it's round, it tells me how to grab it, where to bite it, and so forth. Actions I can take to grab fitness payoffs. But there is no red apple. As soon as I look away and I don't see the red apple, I throw away that data structure. I destroy it because I don't need it. When I look back, I create the data structure again. I'm doing stuff like that on the fly all the time because I have limited memory, limited ability, so I create just the data structures I need, and that's what we call physical objects.
Okay, so I can sort of get that something like an apple is shiny and red, and that maybe constructed in the conscious mind according to what we need it to be to attract us. But what about things like distance? I mean, surely that's real.
If you think about it from the point of view of fitness, the distance between me and that apple 10 meters away is really coding for the amount of calories I would have to expend to get the calories in that apple. And if I see an apple 10 meters away versus 10 miles away, I would be wise to go for the 10 meters, not for the 10 miles, because if I went for the 10 miles, I might spend more calories than I'm going to get. So in some sense, space is a coding of fitness payoffs on offer. That's why when I look, you know, I see a mountain in the distance, and then I see the moon coming up over the mountain, they look about the same distance. Even though the moon is 250,000 miles away and the mountain might only be 20 miles away, but for me, 20 miles is essentially infinity in terms of the caloric. So from my point of view of depth, they're the same distance away because it's impossibly far. I shouldn't be going after those calories. So our space is sort of coordinated that way.
I can see all these kind of dots of information swirling around all of us, and individually our minds kind of draw connections between dots, in particular constellations, and they produce an image of an object for us that gives us an advantage in some way.
But even fitness payoffs themselves are too rich, too much information. And so what we have is a computer science kind of thing. Data compression, error correction. We need to have our senses give us the minimal amount of information about fitness payoffs that is good enough to keep us alive and keep us going.
So why have we got five different senses if none of them tell us what it's really like out there?
There's probably different kinds of fitness payoffs that we have to deal with all the time. There's fitness payoffs having to do with fighting, right? What do I need to do to avoid being hurt in a fight? There's ones for eating, for mating, for running, and there's all these different activities that we might be engaged in, and there'll be different fitness payoffs in each case. The question is there some way that we can create a compact data structure that will handle several of these problems at once in one data structure, right? And so the different modalities correspond to ways where we say, look, okay, for certain fitness information, I need to just change the format. So I suspect that we have different modalities because it's a compact way to get the fitness information we need without overwhelming us, but also to divide it into the separate realms, right? These kinds of fitness problems I can put together into what I call a visual object, but these other aspects to the fitness equation, I can't put it into the object, so I need to put it over here into a sound, or I need to put it over here into a smell, or into an itch, or something like that. And so I think the ultimate story about the reason why we have different modalities of perception is it's going to be a computer science problem.
So the senses are sort of performing this role of fact-checking.
Absolutely. So that would be part of what I call the error correction aspect of things. So whenever you have information being transmitted, you want to compress things as much as possible, which means you want to get rid of redundancy. And yet, there's this competing thing, which is error correction, which is you don't want to make a mistake, and so you want to add redundancy. So there's these competing problems that we have to solve, and so that's what you know will happen here is that we're going to have different modalities as different ways of doing some error correction. There's probably also compression that I can sort of compress things a lot by putting them in different modalities. I talked about that, but now I can compare. So for example, I think that thing is really far away, and my auditory, you know, like the we hear these little flags, right? So I can see visually about how far away the flags are, and my auditory sense gives me an auditory feeling, and usually the two need to agree for me to be. So and even within vision, by the way, when we see depth, we use, for example, stereo vision, the fact that you have two different eyes. They're like cameras that see the world from two different places. They actually get different pictures, right? So the picture in your right eye is slightly different from the picture in your left eye, and you actually use those differences to compute depth. But you can also compute depth by motion. As you move through the world, you see depth from motion. And so those two different ways of getting depth information can be used to check each other and correct each other. And then, again, auditory sound localization with visual localization of depths can be used to check each other. So I absolutely agree that the in the sound domain, which you're particularly interested in, that could be partly, but not exclusively, partly a correction on the depth perception that we see visually. But of course, it brings in all of its own things. I can hear a creature that I might not be able to see. And elephants can use infrasound, right? For miles away, they can't perhaps see each other, or if there's trees in the way, they wouldn't, even if they were close, they couldn't see each other. But they use infrasound as an important way of sending information and receiving information. So yes,
I've often wondered whether everything out there is made of the same stuff, and the different senses just see it in slightly different ways.
Well, every one of the senses is going to be stimulated by, in a physicalist framework, a physical stimulus that will have some kind of vibrational mode. So in hearing, there'll be vibrations of molecules in the air. In vision, there's vibrations of photons or of the quantum fields that photons are part of. In touch, there's going to be mechanical vibrations. It's all about energetic transfers. One of the fundamental equations in physics is that energy equals frequency multiplied by a scale factor called the Planck's constant. So in some sense, anytime you have an energy transfer, which is involved in a sensory system, there's going to be a frequency involved in the energy transfer just by the definition of that, that equation. In some sense, they're part of the essential aspect of what it means to have a communication going on and information being transferred.
Don is so fascinating to talk to that I'd almost forgotten that what we were here to talk about was language.
So the relationship between language and physical objects is really an interesting one. There's something called the Whorf-Sapir hypothesis, which suggests that the language that we use and the concepts in those languages in some sense deeply influence what we can possibly perceive. And that view has been quite popular. I myself think that there are some, of course, influences of language on what we're going to pay attention to and therefore what we're going to see. But the idea that our language fundamentally, in some sense, shapes what is possible for us to see, I think, is deeply wrong. If you look at language learning in infants, they don't start really saying their first words until they're at least 12 to 15 months old. 12 if you're really precocious. And what's happened during those first 12 to 15 months? They have been developing rapidly. 3 months of age, the infant has learned to see depth from motion. 15 to 16 weeks of age, they have depth from stereo. Depth from perspective cues by about 7 months of age. They're booting up their ability to see space and time and physical objects. During the first 12 months of life, it's an amazing accomplishment.
Ooh, a rabbit's just popped out of Don's bag.
So there's a rabbit sitting on the floor, you know, sitting on a mat, say, in front of the child, and all the mom or dad has to do is point to it and say, rabbit, and the child looks at that, and when they're at the right age, often one trial, and the kid gets it. Maybe they'll mistake it for a cat, for a dog, or something like that. All you have to do is say, no, that's a dog, and in just one or two trials, most kids get it. So the language isn't controlling our perception. Rather, we booted up our perceptual system. It's really sophisticated. It's already carved the world into objects. And the language thing is we're just labeling the stuff that's already there. So the Whorf-Sapir hypothesis, I think, is probably false, at least in its strong form. But also it's probably false to say that language has no impact on our perceptions.
And there's something miraculous about the way this takes place.
How does the child know what the mother was talking about? The child knows that the first thing you're going to say is rabbit, and you're not going to say quadruped, you're not going to say mammal, you're not going to say animal, not the ear, not the color. You don't want to say, look, white. They're all true, and they're the wrong thing to say. The mother and the child, or the father and the child, come to this language learning game knowing the rules up front. And this is pre-linguistic. That is a miracle.
It's interesting that the order we learn things is very particular, and it's not the order you might expect.
We're pre-programmed to do the language game on objects in a specific order. Whole objects at what we call the basic level first, and you're paying attention to their shapes. It's based on the shapes. And what's really interesting is when you look at it computationally, shapes are really complicated. They're really nasty. Color is much easier. Texture is much easier. Shapes are nasty. And yet, the computationally more difficult thing is what's programmed into us first, and that triggers the whole language game. So you can see that the relationship between language and physical objects and perception is very, very deep and very, very rich.
When Don was first explaining his consciousness as matter theory, it sort of made me think that perhaps we're all locked in what I might describe as a sort of consciousness theatre, which is a sort of internalized, personal, subjective space where we have no idea what's actually going on, either outside our minds or in the minds of other people. But maybe language brings us together in some way.
That's right. So it's a convenient way, since we're all members of the same species, and our interfaces are very, very similar. So none of us see the truth. We've all been shaped by natural selection to have very, very similar codes for fitness. And we're a social species. Turns out it's been very useful for us to use language to coordinate, to communicate. And so we use language as a way of talking about fitness payoffs and fitness consequences in a socially interesting way.
And this is really interesting because for me and the project, I'm interested in whether the words we use can mean similar things to everyone. But whilst that might be true, that doesn't mean that there's an external objective reality that we all share. And that's what makes this project so interesting and so hard.
We do interact a lot and we talk and communicate. And often we try to come to consensus. And often we do have consensus. I say, I see that there's a red apple on the table, and you look and say, I agree, there's a red apple on the table. So we have consensus a lot of the time, and most of us then take that as evidence that we're all seeing the truth. I mean, the inference we make is, since we both see the apple, and we both agree that we see an apple, therefore that's proof that, logically, proof that there is an apple there. And it turns out if you analyze it, there's no logical proof there at all. So the fact that we have consensus in no way entails that we're seeing the truth. All it entails is that we have our own species-specific user interface. We agree in how to construct our representations of fitness payoffs and how to get them. And so we have a consensus just because we're members of the same species. Consensus is important, but it doesn't mean that we have access to an objective reality.
Color is a continuous spectrum of frequencies of light, but we agree the boundaries between what we call one color and what we call another collectively through language. What's interesting is that the consensus we arrive at has to include everyone in the group, including those with quite different ways of seeing. And that's what allows us to have a conversation about the red apple.
There's some interesting research by some colleagues of mine at UC Irvine looking at language learning for color names. And so they would start off, in the simulation, they would start off with, you know, they have the color circle, you know, all the different hues. And the question was to use just a certain number of language terms and to have a bunch of different observers sort of come to a consensus about where the boundary for red was and where the boundary for green was without, you know, having any a priori constraints on it. See, could we have just some kind of bottom-up learning rule where they interact and they just go back and forth until they can somehow converge? And what they found is that if you have normal trichromatic visual perceivers, so they normally have red, green, and blue cones. And then you also throw into the mix some, like, colorblind men, dichromats, that only have, say, green and blue cones, but they don't have any red cones. And you throw them into the mix, it turns out that when the language game plays out, the dichromats, the ones who are less abled, have an oversized influence on how the whole community puts together their language barriers. Because you need to evolve the language structures such that you can maximally include those who differ the most from you in their perceptions. And so it's a surprising result, but it does make sense that in some sense our interfaces differ. I can't get inside your head directly. You can't get inside my head. You don't know what it's, you can guess what it's like to be me. I can guess what it's like to be you, but it's only a guess. And the best we can do is use language to communicate back and forth. And so what we have to do is sort of negotiate and go back and forth until we finally think that we're communicating pretty clearly. And it turns out when you do that process, it's the differences in our interfaces that end up playing an outsized role in how the language communication probably ends up going.
Regardless of whether there is or isn't any external objective reality, I'm coming around to the idea that the most important thing is our interface and the consensus we arrive at as a group. And I'm wondering whether another word for consensus is culture.
As members of the same species, we're going to broadly share much of our interface. I can go to some remote island near Borneo, and I can show them, you know, a piece of fruit that they've never seen before, maybe a plum or something like that. They won't have any trouble seeing that piece of fruit. Because they have, even though in their culture they've never seen that before, they will pick it up right away. And if I say plum, they'll get it. So I think that because the natural selection pressures on our species are very, very similar, gravity environment, we all have to eat, we all have two arms, two legs, we can't eat eucalyptus. We're going to be pre-programmed with a lot of similarities, but there are also mutations that are happening. And then culturally, the question is, and this has been a big debate, how big an influence does culture have on the raw nature of our experience? And my own take is that I think there is some effect possible. So I could imagine that cultures could influence our experience of the world not so much by rewiring the fundamental nature of our perceptual systems, but by affecting where we attend.
Coming back to this machine that I want to build,
yes.
The impossibility of it is around this objective subjective problem of language. When I say rain and I play you a sound, is it the rain that you expect to hear?
Well, I think it'll depend on the precise language that you use.
There are colors, but there are also many other things that we agree upon, like texture. And in order to talk to each other about the world we're in, we combine these different descriptors of experience. And what I'm hearing from Don is that the most common and deepest meanings find their roots in situations upon which our ancestors' lives depended. It's these deeply ingrained meanings that I want to tease out to make my machine work. Uh-oh.
Suppose I have a run-in with a bear, and I manage to survive it. I'm a lucky guy. Brown is a feature of that, but it's not just a brown. It's a particular texture of the fur of the brown that's diagnostic. I call these things chromatures. The chromatures are not just uniform colored patches, but they're colors with rich textures, and those are far more rich informationally. I could imagine that there could be evolutionary significance to the brown fur texture of a bear if I managed to survive that. That would be very, very important to me. We might say, well, what is the appropriate sound for a color? And I would say that that's the wrong question, because it's not a rich enough input. So rain by itself may be like a uniform color patch. Maybe it's not rich enough. So we might have to have a few adjectives, you know, like thundering rain or ominous rain. So in other words, what you might be able to do to get people go, that's right, you nailed it. You'd have to actually think about two or three adjectives or adverbs or, you know, a little phrase. So a word might not be enough, but a little phrase might be just like going from colors to chromatures. Going from a single word to a little phrase is like going from a color to a chromature. That might then give you just enough to uniquely tap into evolutionarily interesting.
Working with your hypothesis, the installation suddenly becomes a machine that manifests thought. So it's a machine to externalize what's going on in your imagination.
I agree. It can really do that. So you put some kind of sound out there and people go, that's the right sound. That does suggest that you're now tapping into deep parts of the human evolutionary psychology. This would be a really great way to externalize the abstract evolutionary psychological principles that are built into us. So by using this technique to try to expose our emotions, you're really exposing some of the heart and core of our evolutionary psychology.
On this journey, I'm searching for a way to represent words with sounds in a way that's meaningful to everyone cross-culturally. Before this conversation, I was really focused on building something that understood the external world. Don has shown me that I may have been looking in the wrong place, and that I may need to build something that understands us. I shouldn't be searching for words that describe stuff, but rather words that describe how we experience the stuff and how we experience it together.
Something else that helps me.